So welcome back to the Birdie Bug Pod, episode 53. Brilliant. We're back. We're still on schedule for a change.
Exciting episode, this one.
Yeah, we're not going to do any catch-up. We're going to launch straight into it because he's had a lot of mentions on the podcast.
I think
so
actually
far.
He's been mentioned more times than the RSPB.
And maybe even Chris Packer.
that's a lofty height to be lifted up to.
But we finally have Sean on the podcast. He's a friend of mine from my time up at Bangor University. He ran the Entomology Society before I did, then we ran it together. He's also a paleo artist and, as I said off mic, just an absolute legend. So, Sean, thank you for finally coming on the podcast.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure.
Great
to have
be
you
here,
mate.
Yeah, I'll slide that £10 over in just a minute.
So we'll maybe kick it off by giving you a little chance just to say, you know, what it is that you do, a little bit of your background, and maybe also introduce what you wanted to come and talk to us about.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me, first of all. So my name's Sean Hennessy. I go by the alias Speed Thief online, if you've seen any of my stuff on Instagram or Facebook or Reddit. I am a freelance artist. I'm a paleo artist, so I mostly draw dinosaurs and other extinct animals that sort of stem from a long-running passion for paleontology and the wider world of natural history. I'm also a keen bird watcher and just a general animal lover. I could see this going into long rambling digressions here.
We waffle on. So
every single time we've gone, oh, this might be a slightly shorter episode, we then just talk for a good hour and a half.
Yeah, if you could cut this down to make me sound really intelligent and handsome.
Oh, you're very handsome.
We're talking about the intelligent bit, but yeah. you're obviously going to prove me otherwise.
So yeah, I'm mostly known for short form comic strips featuring dinosaurs and other Mesozoic animals. I do a few other sort of lines of paleo art, like graphic design for t-shirts, stickers and all that kind of thing. And yeah, Matt's a long-standing friend of mine since, well, it's probably about 10 years we've known each other.
Yeah,
now,
well, I met you when you were running Entomology Society. That was my first year at uni, so that was 2014. So
oh, really?
It's 11 years now.
Goodness yeah. me.
A long time.
Yeah, God.
I got to know you more because when I started my bird photography and started to get obsessed with that, and my bird ID at that stage wasn't great, if ever I had a bird that I wasn't sure about, Matt said, send me the picture, I'll send it to Sean. Sean will tell you. He'll tell you what it is.
Yeah, so, that's something I've always been happy to do. I'm the person in many people's lives that if there's a weird insect that you found or an obscure brown bird, I'm more than happy to give that. To give that a look. So yeah, Matt and I, I've known each other for about 10 years or so, and that we were sort of brought together through our mutual interest in entomology. And then, yeah, well, it was really through the magic of social media that we started talking. Well, of course, through Matthew as well.
Yeah.
I did just reach out to you directly.
I think there were a few discussions about sighting Dartford warblers as
indeed,
well.
Indeed, yes. I stole a Dartford warbler location off your Instagram last year, which was very successful.
Oh, that's good.
I did get very wet that day, though. And yeah, it's something I've wanted to do for ages. I've been listening to you guys for a long time now. Without starting off too heartfelt and emotional, I think I did pass on it at the time that there was a time about a year and a half ago where I was struggling with some health issues, and that sort of manifested in the inability to leave the house comfortably and drive comfortably, and listening to the Birdie Bug Pod in the background was very helpful. I've got nice calm voices for me to listen to in the background.
Oh, that's heartwarming. It's always nice. So people have told us that we sound quite similar, which to my ears we don't, but that's probably because
you too.
Yeah,
you do.
People have said that we sound quite, especially on the phone. I know your sister's answered the phone to me and thinks that it's you and it's me. So I have people say, I've got a nice calming voice. It's like, just one voice or is it two voices?
it's always nice to hear that people are enjoying them, because Maff and I started this, as I think we touched on a few episodes, that we've always just done this from when he was a little lad sitting chatting, and obviously we've turned that into a podcast, but we don't really know whether people listen to it or not. We've never been too stressed about
no,
that.
No, we just
so
don't
it's really nice
it.
To hear that people are actually enjoying it, and we're not just sitting here talking a whole load of
no, absolutely.
Waffle, you know. So.
I was telling Matt, I've been spreading the word over the weekend. People are, you know, asking, what's the plan after DinoCon? And said, well, I'm actually going on the Birdie Bug Pod to talk about dinosaurs.
Obviously, you know, we're not quite up there with, you know, with some of the big ones, but For What It's Earth podcast.
Sustainababble from back in the day.
Tetsu. Yeah.
Yes, of course.
Diary of a CEO, you know, all of that stuff.
He knows.
But we'll get there.
Yeah, and I mean, actually, it's funny that you and I are finally doing a podcast episode together because at some point, a long time ago, Sean and I had the idea of doing a podcast together called the Arthra Podcast.
Yes.
Oh, I remember you telling me about
but
that.
But trying to organise that remotely was very challenging.
It was, yeah. I think we recorded the best part of an episode in Bangor, didn't we? I think went okay. I don't think I ever listened back on it, to be honest. And yeah, it kind of fell through the cracks a little bit.
So I mean, it's nice that we've degrees, of course.
It's really nice that we've been able to reconvene in the same context now.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're involved as well.
Absolutely. Anyway, we better crack on with the subject. Otherwise, we'll be here for 4 hours, won't we?
Yeah, so, exactly. So
reminiscing and what have you. So
yeah. Well, I guess we'll start off with let Sean introduce his topic, and then maybe we'll kick off with a question from us. But so, what is it that you wanted to come and have a little chat about?
Indeed. So I thought it might be an interesting topic to talk about birds in the context of other dinosaurs. So I think it's fairly well accepted in the general consciousness nowadays that at least birds are descended from dinosaurs. You might have come across some misinterpretations of this in social media saying, oh, yeah, I have a chicken and I can still see the Tyrannosaurus instincts in the chicken as it hunts worms in the garden and that kind of thing. But I don't think there's too much media out there that really covers the topic of not just birds descending from dinosaurs, but birds in the context of other dinosaurs, which put some of their anatomy and their behaviour and their evolutionary history.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely seen, you see those little memes of people, especially if they keep chickens, where they've put a chicken and then like a T-Rex in the background, just like, remember where you came from.
I've got a feeling that that might have been one of my questions to you in our 50th episode. What's the closest descendant to T-Rex? I think it was a chicken. So, you know, it was as cut and dried as that, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think Matt mentioned already that we might talk about a few of the popular myths that we could potentially dispel or clarify. I don't think all of them need to be entirely dispelled, and there's some truth in some of these myths, but I think sometimes the devil's in the details, and that's where the interesting stuff is.
Yeah, definitely. And I think based on if anybody's listened to our cuckoo episode, they'll know that Dad and I have taken an interest in doing a few more topics around sort of evolution and things like that. And so this is a really nice entry point to our slightly more evolution focused episodes. So I thought maybe just to kick it off, we should probably ask you to define sort of what a dinosaur actually is.
Yes, that's a very interesting question. Unfortunately, the most succinct answer is the most boring answer. So the most rigid definition is a dinosaur is any member of the clade Dinosauria, which of course doesn't really satisfy anybody with an answer like that. So the term dinosaur is used popularly by people as a term of convenience, which isn't necessarily the most rigorous scientific definition of the word. For example, if I was to say my favorite group of birds are falcons, for example, that's a monophyletic group. That's a clade of birds we're talking about. Whereas if I was to say birds of prey, that's not. That's a polyphyletic group. They're animals that are combined by certain traits that then we can group them together with a term of convenience like birds of prey. Because if we're talking about going out to see predatory birds, we don't need to distinguish that owls evolved from this part of the bird family tree and falcons evolved from this one. So the point I'm alluding to there is dinosaur, for the longest time, has been used as a term of convenience to refer to any sort of charismatic megafauna of the ancient world. Whereas the sort of truest definition is they're all members of this one branch of the archosaur family tree. Is that at all a useful answer?
I think that's a useful answer. I think trying to make people aware that it's like an umbrella term that is commonly sort of just thrown around as a, like they say, for convenience. Because there are lots of birds that obviously hunt and are carnivorous, but are not birds of prey,
exactly.
For example.
You wouldn't describe a great crested grebe as a bird of prey necessarily. Yeah. But of course it is a predatory bird in every way that
it's a lot more comprehensive than this line I've got here. Dinosaurs are tetrapods that belong to the reptile group like turtles, crocodiles and snakes.
Well, that's certainly not incorrect. And I mean, I certainly don't want to come across like we should constantly correct anybody that calls, let's say, a pterosaur a dinosaur.
Oh, no, you definitely should. I'm not letting that slide.
Oh, thank you. Okay, I can stop talking, saving face now.
You're talking to us and we don't like it when people say seagull. We're like, actually, what gull are you looking at?
But yeah, you know, I think some of the interesting things are in the details there. You know, by excluding some of these well-known extinct animals from the basket of dinosaurs, then we can, it sort of demonstrates how diverse these animals, they're sort of non-dinosaur animals.
Can you not define it though as dinosaurs sharing, all sharing certain characteristics?
Yes, you know, like all members of a monophyletic group, so that being a group of animals that all evolved from the same common ancestor, they will inevitably have some anatomical features, certainly a genetic footprint if we were talking about living animals, or if we could somehow DNA samples from dinosaurs, there would be quite a large group of
Jurassic Park. Why can't we do that? I mean, come on.
Yes, if
they got it out of a mosquito, didn't they?
Yeah, and then combined it with frog DNA. So let's not give Jurassic Park too much scientific credit.
It's true. Of all animals they could have chosen, I think frog was a very weird choice.
It was an odd one, wasn't it?
Yeah, you'd think, I don't know, chicken at least.
I'm not here to diss that film at all. Yeah.
No. Jurassic Park is an absolute talisman of my childhood. I do credit for my interest in...
Yeah, it definitely got a lot of people into that world.
Yeah.
But I guess in that case, could you maybe just give us a little bit of a background on how we do classify dinosaurs and therefore where birds sort of sit
It's all about hips, picture.
Yeah, it's about hips. There's a lot about hips in there.
But it's all in the hips.
It's all in the hips.
Yeah, Elvis had it right. So, yeah, just to give things a little bit more context, because I'm going to... try my best not to just talk in jargon here, because you know, with any specialist subject, including bird watching or entomology, there's a lot of jargon involved.
Especially in like taxonomy and stuff, though.
Yes.
It is hard to avoid some of the scientific terms.
Absolutely. But let's try and just sort of lay the map out a little bit to begin with. So dinosaurs belong to a branch of the reptile family tree. Let's leave that definition of reptile on one side for now. Called Archosauria. So Arco meaning ruling, like monarch. Archosauria. So archosaurs contains the dinosaurs, including birds, of course, and the crocodilians, pterosaurs, and some other related reptiles. From an anatomical point of view, these animals are united by features of the skull, and in some cases their ankles or features of their vertebrae, like depending on which sort of subsection of the tree we're talking about here. So in a simplified manner, we can think of the archosaur family tree as splitting into the croc-line archosaurs, so extant crocodiles, gharials, alligators, and all of their crazy extinct relatives. And then the other side of the tree forms another branch, two sister clades, one of them being the pterosaurs, the flighted reptiles of the Mesozoic, people will be familiar with.
Some of my favourite extinct animals.
Yeah, really, really bizarre animals that have often been done a disservice by popular media by sort of reeling back how weird they actually are. It's something that we might touch on slightly later, but a group of Mesozoic reptiles that almost always get lumped in with dinosaurs, but maybe we'll touch on that a little bit later. So we have the pterosaurs on one side of this sort of split in the branch, and on the other side we have dinosaurs. So yeah, discounted all the other non-dinosaur reptiles for now. Within the dinosaur family tree, there is a little bit of contention about where some of these branches lie exactly, but it's probably most useful to think of dinosaurs as belonging to one of three groups, which is the sauropods, or the often long-necked and long-tailed super giant dinosaurs, the ornithischians, which is quite a diverse group of dinosaurs that contains popular groups such as the horned dinosaurs like Triceratops, the crested or duck-billed dinosaurs like Parasaurolophus, and a number of other well-known dinosaurs, like Stegosaurus and Ankylosaurus, for example. And then last of all, we have the theropods, which are almost exclusively bipedal and predatory dinosaurs, in which the birds are also contained as well. So birds evolve deep within that theropod clade.
And lots of people's sort of favourite dinosaurs often sit within the group of theropods.
Exactly. You know, people sort of tend to be drawn to charismatic, predatory, cool, sleek animals, and most theropods are exactly that.
And you just stop there.
We've got a
visitor.
Every episode, he's like, excuse me, you've left me out of the
office. Speaking of predatory animals.
Yeah. Sorry, I just like hopped in back into the podcast after a slight disruption from a cat. We were just talking about the different branches that sort of split. You've got the pterosaurs, you've got your sort of horned dinosaurs, and then you've got your theropods as well.
Indeed.
And mentioning that often includes your nice, charismatic, bipedal predators, your typical T-Rexes and raptors and things, the ones that people typically remember from Jurassic Park and
yes, like so
that.
if your favorite dinosaur runs around on two legs and has pointy teeth, then it's probably a theropod, almost certainly a theropod. But this group contains a bunch of the superstars: Velociraptor, Tyrannosaurus, Allosaurus, Carnotaurus, etc., etc. The list goes on.
T-Rex wasn't the biggest, was it?
Yeah. Yes. So There's been a lot of research recently about the kind of upper size limits of Tyrannosaurus specifically, and some individuals out there probably would, well, just statistically, there would have been larger Tyrannosaurus individuals than our biggest fossils. The idea that's generally accepted nowadays is that Spinosaurus was at least the longest theropod, but that was an animal built quite differently to...
It's a weird animal as well.
Yeah, really, really strange. Something built a bit more like a heron or an ibis or something like that. Like somewhere in between a crocodilian and an ibis, which is a really weird thing.
That's a strange mix-up.
Yeah. Whereas, Tyrannosaurus was a huge, robust species that was adapted for crushing bones and, you know, ripping the frills and horns off Tyrannosaurus.
And of course, there's been a lot of speculation as to whether they were, you know, fast hunters or whether they just lived off carrion, or I'm not sure you'll ever answer that question.
No, almost
I know Chris Packham
not.
Tried to. Chris Packham did a really good, I think we were talking earlier, did a really good program all about the real T-Rex, he called it. And I think they came to that conclusion that, you know, you see it in the films where it was this hyper-aggressive hunter, and that's maybe not quite the case.
Yeah.
But anyway.
Well, I think large carnivorous animals, whether they're dinosaurs or mammals or aliens in movies, often suffer from this hyper-predatory syndrome where they get locked onto, you know, a human that might be the equivalent of us eating an Oreo or something like that.
I think, find it fascinating as well, the sound that they give these,
exactly. I think I'm not sure who we can credit with the first sort of roaring dinosaurs, because of course that's not something that we necessarily inferred from fossils. Maybe just because we found the skeletons of enormous predatory animals with big pointy teeth, and that makes us think of bears and big cats and things
dragons
like that.
Yeah. And things,
dragons, of course. Yeah. Whereas if we look at what are perhaps the best modern analogues for some of these big predatory dinosaurs, like various bird clades and crocodilians, most of their vocalization is much more guttural.
Mm. Like a rumble.
Yeah, a rumble, you know, works at lower frequencies. You may well have seen footage of alligators and caimans rippling the water on their back because their call is so deep and resonant. I think it makes a bit more sense that some dinosaurs would have communicated like that. But simultaneously, another thing we were talking about earlier, what would it be like to go back and visit the Mesozoic? Yeah. Anybody that's woken up early in the morning in the late spring and heard the dawn chorus, I'm sure will attest to like how moving that can be.
Absolutely.
Now, you know, imagine going to the same spot, but let's say 5,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago before industrialization occurred, and how much more rich and diverse that would be. Well, now imagine a world that's dominated by theropods, not just birds, and not just theropods, other dinosaurs as well that would have had varying levels of vocal ability, if you want to call it that. There was a discovery a few years ago of a syrinx-like organ in an ankylosaur. So modern birds are able to do such complex vocalizations due to their voice box, which is double-chambered. So unlike our larynx, they have two chambers, which is called a syrinx. And to my understanding, a syrinx-like organ was found fossilized within the throat of an ankylosaur. So a dinosaur that's about as far removed from birds as you can get within dinosaurs, yet it had this complex vocalization organ in its throat. So an animal that has often been depicted in popular media as something essentially like a big hippo or a rhino or something like that could well have been
chirping
and warbling like a song thrush.
were they able to, using that model, were they able to recreate what that sound might have been like coming out of that voice box? Or
I've not seen anything on that. It might be the case. There's a well-known example where I can't remember who it was, somebody modeled the internal structure of a Parasaurolophus crest. Now I'm sure everyone's familiar with this dinosaur. It has a long tubular crest that points backwards off the head, which was thought to be an elaborate display feature, but also a resonating chamber. And I think somebody modeled this digitally to sort of reproduce the sound. And it's quite a haunting, horn-like sound. So that's, to my knowledge, the only sort of reconstruction based on actual evidence of dinosaur vocalizations.
But then you always think that, like, if you were to take, I don't know, the voice box equivalent out of a bird and just send air through it, you're not going to get the diverse sound. Same with a human. You could take our larynx out, pump some air through, and you might get like a slightly human noise, but you're not going to be able to replicate the various sounds, especially not what beatboxers do or something like that, out of a human. So it'd be really hard, even if we could like 3D print dinosaur anatomy, to then faithfully think, oh, that must be what they sound like, because you don't know what control they have with the muscles and everything like that.
I'll be honest, I very nearly downloaded some dinosaur sounds on my buttons that you love so much. Yeah, I mean, love my buttons.
If anybody's listened to recent episodes, know exactly how I feel about Dad and his buttons.
But I didn't do that. You'll be very pleased to know.
It's pushing your buttons right now.
Yeah, exactly. Bringing it back to topic, I do feel
could
like...
Can I just add one more point before we move on? I was doing some reading recently about sonation, which is something that I'd not done much reading about before. So sonation is the production of sound by animals not using the voice box. So that's another thing that we would probably never really know about dinosaurs unless there was a very specialized organ or some kind of skeletal or soft tissue feature that was specifically for that purpose preserved. But yeah, as well as producing vocalizations from the voice box like many animals do today, it's entirely possible that dinosaurs engaged in sonation, so producing sounds with other parts of their body.
A bit like crickets do, for example.
Exactly, yeah. So stridulation that we see in arthropods like tarantulas, crickets, other orthopterans and whatnot is a type of sonation. There are several types of hummingbirds that they have specialized tail feathers that vibrate in the air currents and things like that. There's a type of bird, a bird called a manakin. You ever seen the video of a bird that looks like it moonwalks backwards up a branch using tiny little jumps? Well, there's another species of manakin, I think it's called something like the racket-winged manakin, that has these incredible secondary feathers on its wing that vibrate something crazy like 400 times a second that produce like almost a musical note.
The idea of a bird being able to move its feathers at that speed is just mind-blowing.
So there are some closely related species of manakin that engage in sort of wing clapping or body slapping, which is probably how the name of the one that I think it's racket wing manakin or something like that. That's maybe how that behavior started, you know, clapping their body or clapping their wings above their body. But yeah, it's sort of a bit of runaway evolution there, if you like, in the racket wing.
And all these things that we might not ever.
Yeah, of course. You know, there might be a higher pressure for dinosaurs to engage in auditory communication via sonation because they didn't necessarily have a complex syrinx like crown birds do. So yeah, there might have been a lot of slapping and clapping going on in the Mesozoic.
Right. What I was going to say was, I feel like, obviously, we mentioned a little bit about the evolution and Dad, you alluded to it all being in the hip. So I feel like it would be remiss of us not to at least mention something about the hips, because otherwise we've dropped that in there and then left everybody hanging.
Well, we dropped that and Elvis in there, so come on.
Yeah, exactly. So can you talk a little bit about how the hips are related to this whole story of evolution?
You can't see this right now, but Matthew stood in the corner of the room
just gyrating my hips,
his hips just to set the mood.
Don't do that anymore, mate.
Good job it's not a video podcast.
That is why we're not a video podcast.
Exactly. Yeah, so well put, we'd be remiss not to touch on the whole bird hip / lizard hip dinosaur argument. So the longest standing accepted model of dinosaur phylogeny boils down to classifying dinosaurs within one of two groups, maybe three groups, those being the bird hip dinosaurs or Ornithischians and the lizard hip dinosaurs or Saurischians. There is an obscure group of early dinosaurs called Hererosaurs that people aren't quite sure where they fall. They might be early theropods, they might be something else. Let's not consider that for now. But yeah, the reason that this is so confusing, that theropods and sauropods traditionally are classed as lizard hip dinosaurs, Saurischians, but by definition, birds are bird-hipped dinosaurs because they are dinosaurs that have the hips of birds, yet they belong to the Saurischian lizard-hipped clade, which is very confusing. But that is, of course, a demonstration of these cladistic terms being invented before we had any strong information that birds not only evolved from dinosaurs, but are dinosaurs.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's one of those things where the terms just happen. Yeah, it does. I think, again, we're talking off mic during, like, when you first read about this, it's always a bit confusing that you've got birds, which are technically lizard-hipped dinosaurs, but because they are birds, they have bird hips. So it's just one of those things, just a little bit confusing. But you often see, if you sort of dive a little bit deeper into dinosaur evolution, it's one of the things that always pops up is lizard hip and bird hip. So I felt like you probably deserve a little mention, but it definitely does sort of answer the question.
Indeed. Probably 8 or 9 years ago now, there was a paper that caused a bit of a buzz in the paleontological community that proposed the Ornithoscelida or Ornithoscelida hypothesis, which essentially just moved a couple of those nodes around and said that, in fact, maybe the, in quotes, ornithischians are the sister group to theropods, and then sauropods were more closely related to those obscure early dinosaurs called herrerasaurs. But for our general purposes, that's largely irrelevant. These clades diverged so close to one another a long time ago that it doesn't really matter for the purpose of our conversation. And as long as we can sort of bear in our mind that we have the ornithischian dinosaurs, which were mostly plant-eating, mixture of sort of quadrupedal and bipedal dinosaurs there. We've got the sauropods, which are enormous, long-necked, long-tailed dinosaurs. And then, of course, the theropods, which were predatory bipedal dinosaurs, which includes birds.
Brilliant. Well, in that case, what I feel like we should move on to next, which, again, always blows my mind, is sort of the timescale of this. Because, again, I think when we say that, you know, birds evolved from dinosaurs, people sort of assumed that the dinosaurs were sort of wiped out and the remaining ones are now birds. So they've evolved. We no longer have T-Rexes. We no longer have Triceratops. We have great crested grebes and owls. But really, the timeline's not quite that simple. And we've got birds during the what we'd call, you know, the dinosaur eras. And so it's not like they've just evolved, and that's one of the reasons why they're not around anymore. So I wonder if you could sort of just give a little bit more complexity to sort of the timeline and the story of birds and the rest of the dinosaurs.
Yeah, absolutely. So the period of time which people tend to refer to as the Age of Dinosaurs is the Mesozoic, which ended 66 million years ago with the End Cretaceous Extinction Event, the Chicxulub Crater and all the rest of it. And that period of time is partitioned into three periods, the Triassic, Jurassic and Cretaceous, which people will probably be familiar with. Now, some of the most familiar and recognizable dinosaurs of all time, like, for example, Triceratops and Tyrannosaurus, only evolved right at the end of the End Cretaceous. Of the late Cretaceous, sorry, in the Maastrichtian stage. Whereas the first birds, can we run back and just talk about like definition of birds first of all?
Yeah, of course. I asked you to define dinosaurs. I didn't ask you to define a bird.
Yeah, true. Right. So this conversation is a little bit tricky unless we define what we mean by birds. As is the case with all evolutionary biology, there was never a last non-bird dinosaur and a first bird, of course. So talking about when birds first evolved within the Mesozoic depends on what we classify as the first bird. If we want to talk about Archaeopteryx, which is often posited as the first bird, you know, the transitional fossil between dinosaurs with classically dinosaurian traits and dinosaurs with birdie traits.
Well, that was the one that they found in China, wasn't it, I think?
Archaeopteryx was Germany.
Ah, was it?
Germany,
okay.
Yeah. So You're thinking of Sinoceropteryx, which is another important milestone.
Of course I am. Sure.
I looked in your eyes and I saw Sinoceropteryx prima.
I was definitely thinking about that. Well spotted.
Well, actually,
just
quickly then, can you pronounce what it was that you were just thinking of?
No, I'll let Sean do that. Yeah. He's the expert.
So, yeah, that's another theropod. Much more, it's a little bit more removed from birds. Still another fuzzy theropod that played an arguably equally important role in our understanding of the relationship between birds and non-bird dinosaurs. But Archaeopteryx was discovered in Germany in, I think, the 1860s. And this was the first evidence of something that was inarguably birdy. It was covered in feathers, and not just covered in feathers, but covered in veined complex feathers, not just filaments and things like that. And it was generally lithe, had long arms, like we'd expect flighted animals to have, but at the same time, it had a long bony tail. If you were to see this animal in real life, you would probably just think that it's some kind of corvid or, you know, a cuckoo, like a roadrunner, something cursorial with a long tail. But this is an animal that had a long bony tail. It had three digits on its hand that weren't concealed in flesh like a bird hand. So it was around this point when people started to consider more seriously the idea that birds at least evolved from dinosaurs. I think I'm right in saying that this fossil sort of made the news at the time around the publishing of Origin of the Species. Feel free to edit that out if that's wrong.
Yeah, I would know that off the top of my head. I'm not very good with historical dates.
No, yeah, me too. But yeah, that was a key point in terms of understanding where birds came from. Because before that, people sort of didn't really have an idea of where in the vertebrate family tree birds might have evolved from. There have been some other things posited in the past, like they evolved from the weird, obscure taxa that were around in the Triassic and Permian.
What was it evidence, do you think, that of that transition, of that transitional period? Because that's one of the arguments against birds being dinosaurs, is that there was no real evidence of that transitional stage. There's no fossilized evidence, there's no skeletal evidence of that when dinosaurs became birds. Do you think Archaeopteryx was evidence of that transition?
Yes. It's a difficult one to answer. And I think I'd want to qualify that with, it's useful to bear in mind that a lot of the traits that we associate nowadays with birds, because they're the only animals alive today that have them, feathers are the best example. During the Mesozoic, there were lots of animals around that weren't birds that had those features. Yeah. So there were lots of animals that were inarguably not birds. They were theropods or even some non-theropod dinosaurs.
Yeah, well, if you watch Chris Packham's The Real T-Rex, they surmised at the end, they were pretty confident that T-Rex had downy feathers on its neck.
Yes. Well,
I mean, obviously...
T-Rex has always been... Well, let's say the life appearance of T-Rex has always been something quite contentious. The lips or no lips debate is something that rages on through the internet to this day. The feathers versus no feathers. So filamentous integument in dinosaurs is something I find very interesting. So that would be soft tissues that grow from the skin, including feathers, as well as other simpler filamentous keratin-based integuments. And the distribution of those across the dinosaur family tree, or the wider family tree that contains dinosaurs, is really interesting as well. So we now know that indisputably pterosaurs were covered in fuzz, if you'd like to call it. Some people call them pycnofibers for pterosaurs specifically. But the point I'm working towards here is that if we use a bit of phylogenetic bracketing and say, we know that pterosaurs and dinosaurs had a common ancestor, and we know that some dinosaurs had fuzzy structures, and pterosaurs had fuzzy structures, did the common ancestor of those two clades also have fuzzy structures? In which case, we might infer that it evolved once, you know, before the common ancestor of these two clades, and then various clades lost them, or they ended up with more complex version, like modern bird feathers, for example. And relatively recent discoveries from other parts of the dinosaur tree have supported this. So, for example, there's a dinosaur called Kalindodromaeus from Russia, which is an Ornithischian dinosaur, so it belongs to the same group as, you know, your hadrosaurs, triceratops, stegosaurus and whatnot. But it was covered in what you might describe as feathers.
That's amazing.
Yeah, fuzzy integumentary structures. Of course, didn't have the remiges and retroces of a modern bird, because it certainly wasn't flying around or anything like that.
But still not the sort of dinosaur that, especially based on what we typically see in popular culture,
you wouldn't predict that, because, you know, all of our fuzzy dinosaurs for a long time were either near bird dinosaurs or at least theropods. So the animal we alluded to before, Sinoceropteryx, this is a small theropod from China. The name itself means Chinese feathered lizard, Sinoceropteryx prima or prima. So this was, I think, our first evidence of a theropod that is clearly not too close to the bird branch, that was covered in fuzzy integumentary structures in exquisite detail as well, to the point that you can see color banding on the tail.
Wow.
So there's also
after
been
all those years.
Yeah,
wow,
exactly.
That's incredible.
Yeah. There have been studies on the structures within the cells, within the feathers, called melanosomes, which lend pigments to bird feathers. And that's how we end up with all the browns and blacks and sort of earthy tones in our modern birds. Blues and things like that tend to be structural, but like from the melanosomes that we can see in the fossils of Sinoceropteryx and other feathery dinosaurs, we can infer an idea at least of what color they would have been in life. So the currently accepted idea is that Sinoceropteryx was sort of a reddish brown, maybe like a foxy brown kind of thing, with a stripy tail and some darker plumage, if you'd like to call it plumage, like darker coloration around the face, a bit like a bandit mask. So I sort of imagine them as almost like a coati analog or a raccoon analog or something like that. But this was something, even though it is a, let's not go into using that jargon, we won't start talking about coelurosaurs and tetanurans and things like that. This is a dinosaur that, it is a theropod, it's closer to the bird end of the tree than some of the earlier things like, say, Dilophosaurus and Coelophysis. But it certainly doesn't have any adaptations for flight or a beak or anything like that. This is something that was running around, probably doing something similar to, let's say, a fox or a roadrunner or something like that. But yeah, this was something that was covered in...
Yeah, I do also feel like where you sort of hop in with the potential, or I say potential because it doesn't really carry any weight, but the idea that, oh, we're maybe missing links and stuff like that. And I feel like it's always a little bit harsh in the sense that so few animals are ever, in the grand scheme of things, are ever actually fossilized. And if you work your way through a lot of the phylogenetic tree, you can see more bird-like features popping up in the fossil record. And Sean can obviously jump in if I say anything too stupid. But the idea that we...
Can I just jump in? Yeah.
I feel like the idea that we might just stumble across a fossil that's perfectly half non-bird dinosaur and perfectly bird dinosaur and be like, look, there we go, that's the missing link between the two, job sorted. Yeah. That, you're asking a lot there from an evolutionary point of view.
Well, the thing I always forget is the time scale as well, that this evolution will take place over, because, you know, T-Rex just didn't become a bird overnight. You know, that evolutionary process might have been a trait of, you know, one by one, those things evolving.
But now, are we going to allow you to say the T-Rex became a bird?
All right.
You kind of beat me to it.
Theropods.
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
I should have said theropods.
Good.
Sorry. I'm so sorry. But obviously there's that evolutionary timescale that we can't even get in our heads because, you know, 10 million, 20 million... 50 million.
Indeed, you know,
it's bonkers.
I've heard some slightly more unhinged version of that example that Matt just gave. Like, have you ever seen a transition in between a dog and a starfish? Checkmate, evolutionists.
Yeah. No, I'm going back to my, you know, closest descendant to the T-Rex is a chicken. So that's why.
Yeah. Right. In that case, I'm going to, because I feel like this topic's so easy just to, there's so much to unpack.
Honestly, I feel like this isn't a complaint. I feel like we're pinballing around now, which is really good and demonstrates how much there is to talk about. But
because of there's so much to talk about, we can go down all these fascinating different like sort of rabbit holes. I was going to bring it back to two key questions that I feel like we've been skirting around for Sean. One is, obviously, I know we've just gone trying to talk about how we define a bird as opposed to the non-bird dinosaurs, but just give a little bit of context as to the earliest what perhaps we would call a bird as opposed to a non-bird dinosaur, to sort of give the idea that they were around at the same time as the non-bird dinosaurs. And then maybe we'll just move on just a little bit, because we had a little laugh about it, dispelling that idea that things like T-Rex then became a bird.
Yeah.
And so to sort of put those two sort of key points and just to bring it back to the topic.
Is that you making me feel stupid?
No, not at all.
I think a more useful way to think about this is around the time when birds evolved in the mid-Jurassic, the first birds were just one of many groups of small-bodied, feathery or fuzzy, energetic theropods running around. And because we didn't evolve at a time when there were diverse clades of dinosaurs around, there was just one, crown birds, we associate those traits, feathers and, you know, all the other things that appear to us now as very birdy traits, those were common across many different groups of theropods at the time. And it just so happens to be that only that one group was equipped to survive all of the horrible conditions caused by the end KT extinction. So, you know, birds belong to this extremely diverse group of animals called dinosaurs. But let me ask you both, what does the word dinosaur evoke for you?
Oh, I think for me, I mean, this is obviously coming, I very much now see birds as dinosaurs. I mean, and I wore a hoodie from Tetsu that said, do you know all those little flying dinosaurs you see every day? I think most people just call them birds. So obviously I come from that point of view, but still, all of that aside, you hear the word dinosaur, it takes me back to a proper prehistoric Earth, huge, incredible diverse ecosystems with massive crocodilians alongside all sorts of different, again, influenced by Jurassic Park, but that thing that's just so far removed from what we would look at as the natural world nowadays. So it just takes me back to that proper age of giants.
Yeah.
Even like pre-dinosaurs, going back to the massive dragonflies, just that world of everything being huge and breathtaking.
Yeah, of course. And I mean, I think you're probably part of the minority there in that, well, I think from being friends with me for a decade, I've indoctrinated you into modern paleontology.
Yeah. So maybe we should ask, see what your
No, it would be exactly but... the same. For me, it would be just the scale. It's the scale of those animals, that unbelievable sight of seeing a 35-metre sauropod. And as we were talking earlier on, not just individually, but in a herd, if that's what you want to call them, walking across a plane or something, that must have just been the most extraordinary thing. For me, dinosaur just means size, scale, extraordinary.
You know, I think like those are two perfectly valid answers. And I think what interests me is what has influenced that perception for you two. Like when the word dinosaur evokes ideas of like huge creatures in the past, what pieces of media do you think?
Well, it wasn't Dino from the Flintstones because he wasn't actually that big, was he?
But, I mean, my earliest would definitely be, and I can't remember the name of it off the top of my head. I still have it, but like my first dinosaur book always had that typical, here's a little silhouette of an adult human and here's the silhouette of the dinosaur. So every single page is like, oh, there's a little human giant dinosaur. So wherever you're looking at sort of fossils and site reconstructions, probably very outdated reconstructions now, but on every page there was like, look at the scale compared to a human. So it was always put into that context of just look at them. So
mine was probably, I'm showing my age here, a very bad black and white film of Godzilla. You know, so that as a child, that was a wow. You know, that was incredible to think that might have actually walked on the earth. All right,
gone off to Tokyo, or
something similar,
or
to
something
that.
Similar to that.
I don't think Tyrannosaurus has any fossil evidence of atomic breath or anything.
Yeah. No.
That would be cool though.
Yeah, but that imagination of and when I was a child, you know, that was a dinosaur to me. And so
it was something. You know, Godzilla is, I think, in many ways, an approximation of a dinosaur. Famously, it is a bit of an allegory for war or the atomic bomb and stuff like that. But it is interesting that humans have come up with that sort of imagery and that kind of iconography. When you think of what's the biggest, scariest beast, you know, we're not talking about an industry or an ideology here. Like, what would be the biggest, scariest beast that you could imagine? And it's essentially a theropod dinosaur.
Yeah, it's essentially T-Rex.
Stomping it around.
I'm pretty sure most people would say T-Rex, wouldn't they?
Yeah, of course. And I mean, that's probably the trait that dinosaurs are known best for.
Yeah.
Attaining enormous sizes. Dinosaurs were the largest terrestrial animals of all time. Sauropods take that title. Don't ask me which one is currently.
Is it not Argentinosaurus?
Argentinosaurus is one that's often pushed up there as one of the biggest. Recently, people might be saying Patagotitan, which is another huge titanosaur.
Cracking name as well.
Yeah, exactly. The titan from Patagonia.
But you can't just imagine the size of that animal that actually walked on this earth.
I'd say it's just impossible.
Incredible.
I've never seen a whale close up in
real life, or
certainly not a baleen whale, like anything big.
I think I saw Steve Batchel swim with a blue whale. I think he did a film, and the cameraman panned back to give you this incredible scale of a 5.5-foot human and a, you know, an 80-foot whale or whatever it was.
Yeah,
and it was extraordinary, absolutely extraordinary.
It's hard to imagine seeing that.
I'm sorry, but my cat seems to be snoring. I hope this isn't coming through on the podcast.
I think he's sort of formed into a right angle in the corner of the chair.
Keep it down over there, doodles, mate.
Yeah, I think it's hard to imagine that sort of grandeur imposed on a terrestrial animal, because not to undermine the evolutionary successes of whales, sorry whales, but you know, you can kind of just linearly get bigger and bigger and bigger. The water is still supporting all of your anatomy and stuff. And as long as you can get enough shrimp in your mouth, then you can be that big. Whereas if you're an animal like a sauropod, the earliest sauropods would have been very similar to the earliest theropods. It would have been a bipedal animal, long tail, kind of generalist arms and hands and mobile neck. And if you start off with a bow plan like that and you want to evolve to become 80 tons and 40 meters long. Not that, of course, these animals had foresight and were intending to evolve like that, of course, but there's a lot of changes to your anatomy that you have to undergo in order to just fight back the physics, really.
Yeah, and just support that amount of weight and absolutely also fuel that amount of weight as well.
So when did the... Oh, I'm going off on a tangent again. The miniaturisation start, because obviously for the birds to evolve, there must have been a big shrinkage in size.
Yeah, well, I think we were walking in that direction before, talking about dinosaurs have always been known for the size, but there's probably a lot more disparity in dinosaur body size than people realise. I think the biggest dinosaurs get the lion's share of the limelight.
Which is, I mean, the same for extant animals, of course, isn't it? Yeah. You're the megafauna.
Charismatic megafauna.
Yeah, your tigers, your elephants get a lot more love than your much smaller mammals, for example.
I mean, did this happen after, the mass extinction? Where
animals
had to adapt in different ways to food resources. And
Well, the extinction event almost certainly acts like a filter in that the larger dinosaurs would have found it harder to fuel a body that size. Yeah. Anything that struggled to disperse long distances would have struggled to find enough food.
Because I sometimes think we forget that not everything on the planet was wiped out.
Yeah.
There were still dinosaurs after the extinction.
Well,
there's
still dinosaurs now.
Spoiler. You're going to keep pulling me up on this. I'm not going to say anything there. Carry on.
Yeah, sure. Well, some of the anatomical features that made dinosaurs so successful laid the foundations for birds to become the super speciators, super travelers, super generalists and specialists that they are today. So some of the common features amongst dinosaurs include skeletal pneumaticity, which means their elements of their skeleton contain air-filled sacs that are then connected to their lungs. So birds and, by extension, by inference, other dinosaurs use tidal breathing. So when a bird breathes in, its next breath out isn't that same breath that it just breathed in, like us.
That's crazy. Just sort of wrap your head around.
Yeah, I might have mixed the two there. I think the simple in and out is tidal breathing, like we do. But some modern lizards, crocodilians, and birds have this complex system in which they take a breath, they breathe out, and that breath out is the previous breath from the sort of previous cycle. Then when they take another breath in, that first breath from this is going to be confusing to explain, but the first breath is then distributed into the air sacs that are sort of auxiliary to their lungs and sometimes penetrate into the bones. So there's a much more complex breathing system going on there. And that not only predisposes you to evolve into a flighted animal that can respire very efficiently, which is of course necessary for flying and other energetic activities, but it also allows you to get really, really big. If we were to go back and pinch a sauropod that was about the size of, say, a large African elephant today and pop them both on the scales, the sauropod would be a lot lighter than you'd expect it to be. And the reason that they did get so big, and we're kind of dispelling another one of the common myths about dinosaur science, people say, oh, the reason that sauropods like Brachiosaurus or Argentinosaurus got so big is because there was more oxygen in the air back there, which is not true. I think the consensus is that the atmosphere was roughly similar during the Mesozoic to modern times, probably a bit less CO2 now, in the
just a little bit,
probably. Yeah. Someone's going to come and say, actually, due to this geological event, there was actually more CO2 in the air. I'm not a geologist or climate scientist or anything like that. But yeah, the reason that sauropods were able to get so big is because they started off with a body plan that made them very efficient respirators and very lightweight for their size.
That's very interesting. It's definitely not... Yeah, I mean, again, that's not something I really considered when you think of how light birds are and that. And you would never really... I would never have made the connection of that's actually why they got so big, because they're not supporting the weight that you, like you say, would if it was an elephant, for example, of trying to get to that size. It's a really interesting connection for me because I'd never really thought of it like that.
Yeah.
So is it down to hollow bones?
Essentially, Yeah, essentially. So there's a much lower ceiling for mammals in terms of the body size they can attain, because their body just isn't as lightweight and pneumaticized as those of dinosaurs. So yeah, you can think about it this way. Let's say the ancestral Saurischian dinosaur, which then later evolved into giant quadrupedal sauropods and into birds like this little sparrow we can see sitting there on the picture on the wall, not in the room.
not in the office.
This suite of anatomical traits that the ancestral Saurischian dinosaur had was a good starting point to either grow into an enormous behemoth that was 80 tons or more, or it's also a useful anatomical trait in order to make yourself really small, lightweight, and then you can fly and you can disperse your species around the country. You can capitalize on food sources that other animals just could not reach in time, and
yeah, and
all that kind of thing.
Obviously, then that lands in really nicely to the sort of thing that prompted that you're talking of. That so I'm pointing to that you're bringing up. Obviously, the mass extinction would have then created all sorts of different climatic environments and perhaps a shortage of food. And those smaller, more mobile birds are going to be able to disperse, find the food sources, and not need quite so much perhaps to fuel them, whereas those massive 80-ton, perhaps a lot slower moving dinosaurs, not going to be able to adapt cross huge swaths.
I like swaths.
I'm going to go swaths. Yeah, huge swaths of perhaps
land. I'm going to start calling you swath-you.
Swath-you. Of land that maybe didn't have very much food or water.
Yeah, because I guess competition for food was pretty fierce.
Yeah, I mean, you know, when there's a giant rock the size of Texas that's smashed into the side of the planet and it's messed up the entire water cycle and the climate and everything like that, food is going to become a lot more scarce. And that's what I was sort of pointing to towards in terms of a big filter.
Yeah.
The filter of extinction.
Yeah, so it wasn't necessary that it wiped out dinosaurs apart from those that could evolve into birds. It was the fact that all of them were sort of existing, but the birds were the ones that could capitalize or survive in such a changing climate, whereas the other ones just didn't.
Yeah, I think a useful analogy to think of is, let's imagine pre-humans, we're in the Cenozoic, in the so-called age of mammals, and let's imagine that a hypothetical extinction event happened that wiped out all large-bodied mammals, and the only mammals to survive are bats, because bats can disperse here and there, their physiology makes them a little bit more adaptable. This is just a...
Hypothetical.
Yeah, exactly. And if that were to happen, you wouldn't then say, oh, well, all the mammals went extinct during this period. We still have mammals today because we have bats.
You
that
also
are sole representative
wouldn't
of
say, oh, all humans must have then evolved into bats to survive. It was just that those other mammals were not able to survive and we just left with
and we
bats.
Haven't even touched on marine animals at the time.
No, of course. The end Cretaceous extinction was almost equally disastrous, to my knowledge, marine life.
There weren't any dinosaurs in the sea.
Only birds.
Only birds.
Yeah. Within the context of dinosaurs, only birds have become marine. There were some other large-bodied reptiles. Some of them we touched on very briefly before when we were talking about animals that tend to get lumped in, into the umbrella term of dinosaurs. Famous ones being plesiosaurs, long-necked marine animals.
You mean the one that's in Loch Ness?
Exactly. the one extant clade of plesiosaurs that lives in Inverness.
The only one left.
Yeah, exactly. Poor thing. Must be cold up there.
Sorry, it's got the whiskey.
It's got his whiskey jacket on. Pliosaurs. And pliosaurs, people are probably most familiar with things like Diplodocus. It was in Walking with Dinosaurs, so sort of.
Wasn't there an ichthyosaur?
Ichthyosaurs, yes. So those are the sort of dolphin-shaped marine reptiles the south of England is famous for, the Jurassic Coast, Mary Anning, so on and so forth. And perhaps more recently, people have become more familiar with mosasaurs.
Jurassic World,
yeah. Interestingly enough, people often associate lizards with dinosaurs, terrible lizards. Dinosaurs means terrible lizards. And of course, dinosaurs are nowhere near related to lizards, which they belong to a different part of the reptile family tree. They're lepidosaurs, so they are related to snakes and tuatara, etc. But mosasaurs are actual lizards. Like they're not just an obscure large group of.
Oh, I actually didn't know that. They're a massive marine lizard.
They are true lizards. Yeah. So I think the idea currently is that they belong to the same group of lizards as monitors and.
Yeah, that makes sense. Actually, I could see that.
Gila monsters, bearded lizards, and anguimorph lizards, so like slow worms.
Yeah,
and
that's wild.
Slow worms and gully wasps. And
so sort
like
of
that.
Lump them with a little slow worm in the garden that eats some slugs, and you've got this huge predatory.
25 meter mosasaur with Hoffmanni.
Basically the same thing, it's fine.
Pretty much, exactly.
Can I just ask one more question about that closest relative?
Yes.
Or descendant? They talk about the chicken. Something like an ostrich, which is obviously a more theropod-like, I would have said. Is that a good example of a living dinosaur? more so than a winged bird, would you say?
I'd say by definition, all birds from ostriches all the way down to goldcrests are all equally theropods.
That's what I wanted to hear. That's exactly what I wanted to hear.
We don't define dinosaurs by the absence or presence of certain traits,
because body size
or the structure of limbs or anything. All members of that clade all descended from the common ancestor, so they are all by definition theropods. So they're all dinosaurs.
Right, okay, in that case, Sean, what I think I might ask you to do sort of round up after that lovely quote of an ostrich and a goldcrest are just as equally dinosaurs as any other bird. So I was just wondering if you could sort of close that thought out by talking about how the birds today are sort of the last remaining dinosaurs rather than, say, the end product of dinosaurs evolving into what we call birds today.
Yeah, I think that's a good way to put it. Sometimes it feels like just a point of pedantry to go, actually, dinosaurs are still alive today. Birds are dinosaurs.
Yeah, sorry, Dad, I've done that to you a lot this podcast.
I can take it, mate, it's all right.
But I think not to do that robs birds of this fascinating evolutionary path they've had since the start of the Mesozoic. And, undermines the whole grandiosity of the fact that we have dinosaurs still with us today. And, when the first birds, however we want to define that, however we want to move the label up and down the tree where birds proper start, birds have been around for tens, if not close to 100 million years before some of those iconic dinosaurs came on the scene. And the first bird-line dinosaurs were as unremarkable amongst their close relatives as, say, shrews are amongst mammals today. Poor shrews, yeah, sorry shrews. A lot of our understanding of bird anatomy, bird behaviour, distribution around the planet is all based in this fascinating story of dinosaur evolution. And I think it would be a disservice to birds to not place them within the context of other dinosaurs. And as the last remaining dinosaurs that persevered through this catastrophic extinction, rather than just refer to them as they are descended, they're tangentially related to dinosaurs, these are the surviving dinosaurs that are still with us today.
They're the ones that made it.
What you basically are saying in very simplistic terms, Sean, is that birds are living dinosaurs.
Birds are living dinosaurs.
Exactly. So anybody listening that has an interest in birds, bird watchers or bird keepers or anything like that, the next time you hear a song thrush singing a beautiful melody from the top of a tree, or if you eat a chicken sandwich, remember that you're interacting with the last remaining members of this charismatic group of reptiles.
Isn't
that
a fantastic thought?
Fantastic thought. I just thought, and I know that Dad's got some fun little questions which we'll move on to before we then dip into your incredible world of paleo art. But how we always talk or describe you as someone who never grew out of their dinosaur phase? Because as kids, we all love dinosaurs.
Exactly.
But then there's a real stereotype for as you get older, you then really get into bird watching, and there's memes online of how it creeps up on you. People who have never been interested in birds will suddenly look out their window and be like, that's a great crested tit. Maybe I'm into birds now. And maybe is that just the adult version of being a dinosaur kid?
Pretty much. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I think, everybody should have their life sandwiched by dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Started off with reading dinosaur books as a kid.
End as a bird watcher. We're all just living through different phases of being obsessed with dinosaurs.
Exactly. Do we want to do questions now, or are we going into?
Yeah, there's just
now?
A couple of things.
Yeah,
a few things I wanted to ask to find out more about Sean. So, what or who inspired you when you were younger? Who was the inspiration? I mean, we obviously often talk about David Attenborough, and was there someone specifically that really inspired you to get into wildlife and that passion that you have for birds and insects and everything?
That's
wildlife.
A good question, really. I would say, first of all, the film Jurassic Park had a big impact on my life. It really sparked my interest in paleontology, but not just that, just the natural world in general. So I think I do have paleontology to thank for my broader interest in the natural world, and perhaps even for my interest in art as well, because I think my method of understanding and appreciating the beauty of animal anatomy came through drawing them. Sort of gaining a fuller understanding of how a bird wing folds up next to the body by drawing that in in several stages, or getting to grips with the diversity of bird feet or bird beaks through illustrating that. So visual media like films, including Jurassic Park and the 1999 Walking with Dinosaurs, were very influential on me as well. Yeah, certainly had a part to play. In terms of people, yeah, David Attenborough certainly gets a credit without a doubt. I met David Attenborough when I was about 8 or 9 years old.
Oh, really? Oh, really? Wow, that's amazing. Where was that?
That was in the Trafford Centre in Manchester. This was around the launch of Life in Cold Blood.
Oh, I had that on DVD.
Yeah, the herpetology programme by David Attenborough via the BBC. And yeah, he just happened to be doing a signing there that day. So I begged my mum and dad, please, I want to go meet David Attenborough. And the sad part about that story is my dad managed to get one picture of me speaking to David. And I was shaking his hand and said, you know, you're massively inspirational to me. Thank you for everything you do. My dad took one picture and my sister was stood in front of the camera.
Oh, no.
And then we all got ushered out.
You, did
yeah,
you?
Exactly. And we all got ushered out of WH Smith after that. So yeah, David Attenborough certainly has.
Just on that, so have you been drawing that art? You talk about art. Have you been doing that from a young age?
Yeah, I've virtually been drawing
since. So you've been drawing dinosaurs, you know, when you were doing that T-Rex, that very basic T-Rex.
Absolutely.
When you were young.
Yeah, drawing dinosaurs is probably a staple for many kids during their dinosaur phase. And I just never grew out of that. Yeah. I've been drawing my whole life, and I'm now lucky enough that I get to spend part of my time drawing silly dinosaurs as a grown man.
Fantastic. Well, we'll touch on that a little bit in a minute. A few others. If you could see only one dinosaur, what would it be and why?
Long-tailed tit.
an osprey.
Not too difficult. We'll try and get Matt his life tick, long-tailed tit this year. It's a really difficult question because I spend a lot of time drawing dromaeosaurids, which are generally known to the public as raptors, Velociraptor, Deinonychus, etc. And for me, they're just the perfect middle ground between birdie features and non-birdie features. Just really awesome. Like, it essentially, instead of a rubbery bipedal Komodo dragon looking thing that's running around a kitchen in Jurassic Park, imagine something with the gravitas of an eagle, but walking around on 2 feet with this huge scythe claw and piercing gaze. I think that would be a really awesome animal to sort of connect with. But from a paleo artist point of view, I think we have a fairly good idea of what dromaeosaurs would have looked like in real life. There's a quote from a book, and I can't remember which book it comes from now, but it says that if the average person was to see a Velociraptor today, that they'd probably go, oh, that's a weird bird, I wonder what that is. They wouldn't think, oh my God, a dinosaur.
Yeah. Bridgeton, that's a funky looking turkey.
Yeah, exactly. So I think from a paleo artist point of view, it'd have to be something that's quite enigmatic. I think, well, I'd really want to know how the facial tissues on, say, I don't know, a hadrosaur would look in real life, or what would the soft tissue, fleshy parts look like on this kind of dinosaur. So very difficult question to answer. Easy answer would be a dromaeosaur. The longer answer would be an obscure group of dinosaurs that we really don't know.
Yeah, something that would sort of really enhance our understanding of what they actually look like.
Yeah, exactly. And some of these really tiring debates online about, did these animals have cheeks? Did they have lips? Did they have feathers, et cetera, et cetera?
Yeah. Okay. All right, I'm going to do some quick fire ones now. Not particularly dinosaur related, but you can only choose one. Birds or reptiles? It's not that quick fire, is it?
Well, by many definitions, birds are reptiles.
Yeah, that's Sean. That's Sean. I made. Sean made eye contact. I was like, "Is he going to let it go? Is he going to answer?"
No, you can take me down on that. That's fine.
Well, as we were talking about at the beginning, obviously,
birds or reptiles, Sean. It's one or the other, mate.
Modern birds.
moths or butterflies.
Moths.
Gannet or puffin.
Gannet.
Adder or sand lizard.
Adder.
Goshawk or osprey?
Goshawk.
Frogs or toads?
Technically, toads are frogs.
See, this is a problem. Doing a quick fire with Sean.
I love it, because just before he makes eye contact with me, and I just sit there just
he's looking at you saying, can I call your dad a dick?
I wasn't thinking. I will say frogs, because that contains both.
Good answer. Wetlands or heathland?
Ooh. Wetlands.
Coffee or tea?
Tea.
Jacket potato or chips?
chips on jacket potato.
Oh, potato sweat.
Really? No, that's something I've never tried. Beer or whiskey?
Ooh, whiskey.
That'll do. Okay, I think we've got
the correct answer. That's really good.
I did have one other, but it might not. Rock or pop?
Now, did you know that rock actually is
pop? Yeah, rock, and actually it's nestled quite deeply within the clade of popper forms. I'm more of a hip-hop guy.
Okay, rock or pop or hip-hop?
Rock.
Okay, I'm done.
Brilliant. Well, in that case, we'll rewind a little bit to the question we were just talking about, getting to know Sean. Go back to your paleo art, because we've spoken a little bit sort of throughout this episode how we all start with a dinosaur face. So many of us do. And then obviously we become bird watchers. But one of the beautiful things about your paleo art and the comics involved in it is it's a really nice blend of scientifically accurate drawings of extinct animals with a bit of humour. And it sort of brings in those two different people who like comics, people like dinosaurs, maybe who are only like one or the other, or like both. How did you sort of decide, or maybe you didn't decide, but how did you fall into using your paleo art as almost like a gateway drug for people to get into science, natural history, and paleontology?
I think I could probably give the credit to the people that see my stuff online rather than myself. I've been making short form comics for quite a while, not necessarily on a particular theme or anything like that. I've always been into reading web comics and, you know, Gary Larson's The Far Side and like other well-known short strips. And as mentioned, I've kind of always been drawing dinosaurs as well. So in some ways it was inevitable that would happen eventually. But around, when was it? Probably 2019, I drew the first sort of like pre-Speed Thief dinosaur comic that people seem to enjoy online. I try my best to participate in an online event called Inktober that people might be familiar with or may not be. So during October, the idea is to do a new drawing every single day based on a set of prompts that's released the month before. And being a dinosaur artist, my entries into an Inktober almost always related to dinosaurs anyway. But one year I started to mix in a couple of comics and people really liked them. There was a really good reception to them, so that kind of steered me towards, yeah, just producing more dinosaur comics. It got to the point where I sprinkled in a couple of comics during one Inktober, and then it slowly became Comic-tober towards the end. And then the two following years, I did a brand new comic every single day for each
Inktober. You're taking something that's already very difficult to do a new drawing every single day, and then just injecting another challenge of then writing something comedic every single day.
My girlfriend will tell you that I'm good at making things difficult for myself, and then moaning about it the whole time.
Get writer's blank. Do you sort of
absolutely. A question I get a lot is, you know, where do you get the inspiration or the ideas for the comics? And it comes from so many disparate things. If you might read the book later, if you read any stories in there that are embarrassing, that's probably something that happened to me in real life. Writer's block is very real. If you were to go through my Instagram account and chart out when those posts actually come, you'll see a lot of long hiatuses where I sort of fell out of love with art for a little bit and felt quite uninspired. But to revisit that earlier point, sometimes I'll be inspired by my parents' dog doing something silly, and you think, oh, you totally imagine a dinosaur doing something like that. Or likewise, I'd spend a lot of time looking at wild animals, mostly birds or zoo animals as well. And so many of these whimsical behaviors that you observe in living animals were almost definitely present in dinosaurs, because why wouldn't they be? We have to remind ourselves sometimes, because dinosaurs are probably most commonly engaged with via popular media, that tends to portray them with an air of them being sort of non-animal fantasy creatures in a way.
Yeah, they're not far removed, because they, again, things like dragon stuff pop up are so heavily influenced by our idea of dinosaurs. You do sort of pitch them as these quite dramatic, grandiose fantasy creatures rather than just what you'd see, you know, like say your dog or some birds or all the funny humorous wildlife photos that we see of the modern animals. No reason why they wouldn't be out there doing the same thing.
1,000,000%. Absolutely. And that's one of the main themes that I want to convey with my comics, is that, you know, here's a brief glimpse through a window back into the Mesozoic. And of course these animals weren't making quips to each other and you know, having,
or were they?
Or were they? Or, you know, having anthropomorphic relationship problems or anything like that. But the goal is to represent them as just animals that happen to not be here anymore.
Yeah.
It's great though, isn't it, how that little idea of yours and the posting up a little bit on social media, and then people start to latch onto it, and then it escalates and it grows, and next thing you know, you're publishing a book. I love that. I'm always fascinated by that process of how things develop. And, you know, obviously next thing for you is international fame and fortune. We understand that. So
that happened last year.
Yeah. Oh, did it? You've already been there.
I'm kidding.
But I like that way, those little things, you know, your little passion, you put it up on social media, people latch onto it, and then that idea develops into something and grows, and here you are publishing books, and it's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of sinister and negative things related to social media, sure, as we all know.
Yeah.
But one thing it has granted me is access to a community of people that is equally obsessive about things.
Passionate.
Like, dinosaurs and natural history as I am. And it's only really through posting this work on social media and connecting with these people that I've then gone on to start printing my work, selling it via online stores, then attending conferences and selling there, meeting people,
making great pun t-shirts.
Making punny t-shirts, yeah, and, you know, collaborative projects with other people. So within the space of 4 years or so, with the support from other artists and people in the paleontological field, I've gone from selling a couple of prints online to having a signing event with myself published book. And that's only really been possible via that connection with the paleosphere. Yeah.
I mean, somebody's even got both your logo and one of your drawings tattooed on them.
Yeah, one of my more well-known comics features Tyrannosaurus, and a kind of creepy-looking, a kind of goofy-looking Tyrannosaurus chick, and somebody was so taken away with that they decided to get it tattooed on their bicep. So.
Which, I mean, that is a real mark that you've made it, I think, that you've put your artwork out there. I think before we completely wrap up, because we've bombarded you with questions for ages, I just wanted to touch on, with your art, how you sort of view paleo art and the comics as sort of scientific communication as well, because it's very easy to look at it and be like, oh, it's a really nice sort of humorous comic with some beautifully drawn dinosaurs, but how you sort of love to use that as a means of communicating the science.
Yeah, I think without sounding too grandiose, we're in an age of misinformation right now, and there's an ongoing climate crisis. We need as many people as we can to be tuned into reality, the natural world, appreciation for science, and there is a bit of a worrying movement away from that in recent times. And dinosaurs are ambassadors for the natural world. They're ambassadors for science. There aren't many kids that have a Bunsen burner phase. People, you know,
hopefully,
there probably are some arsonist kids out there that did. But
I did set fire to the curtains in the chemistry lab when I was at.
And I did make a very, very loud explosion in the garage, making helium gas.
Yes,
you did. No, hydrogen gas rather.
Maybe I gave the wrong example. But,
anyway,
You know, dinosaurs are ambassadors for the natural world, for the sciences. They are that big, glamorous, shiny hook for people to get interested in the natural world, to go and visit a museum and see a giant sauropod mounted on some cables, or to see an exquisitely made sculpture of a living theropod or something like that. And of all those people that start off with a dinosaur phase, very few of them will go on to become paleontologists or geologists or paleoartists. But I think that really opens the door for a curiosity and a passion for the natural world. So I think dinosaurs are a powerful tool for opening people's eyes to the scientific method and valuing the natural world.
You could also argue, couldn't you, that birds being living dinosaurs are now an indicator species of what's going on in the world with climate change, because migratory patterns are changing, because the planet's warming up. And so there's still a really good reference point to what's happening in this world.
Yeah, and I think you could really easily see that pipeline of, and you know, say somebody stumbles across, whether it's your own art, somebody else's paleo art interested in dinosaurs, maybe your comic references the fact that birds are living dinosaurs, that kid gets interested in birds, reads about birds, suddenly realizes their favorite birds are actually on the decline because of the climate crisis, fuels an interest in, right, I want to conserve and protect my favorite bird. Now that's obviously a very hyperbolic idea, but you could see it happening. It doesn't take a lot for somebody to be, oh, I never thought about that. Takes an interest in birds, realizes what's going on, and then has a passion for, I want to stop this. And so the fact that you can take something that's so universally appealing, like a dinosaur, an extinct dinosaur, and perhaps have that impact of then channeling someone to want to conserve the extant dinosaurs, is just, I think, an amazing way of doing it.
It's a fantastic platform, isn't it, for highlighting.
I think the word extinction is so closely tied to the idea of dinosaurs. Yeah. You know, like, we used to have dinosaurs, but now they're all extinct and we just have fossils, is, you know, the sort of general understanding of that. Well, let's put it this way, you know, birds are our sole surviving clade of dinosaurs to this day. They made it through the KT extinction. Enormous meteor from space came down and disrupted the entire planet. And in the face of that, this group of dinosaurs persevered, survived, re-diversified, filled some of these large animal niches, filled some of the, you know, sort of wide dispersing and super speciating niches as well. And now humans have come along and they're facing another mass extinction, the mass extinction of the Anthropocene. So yeah, these incredible survivors from that have their roots in the Mesozoic and now at risk of going extinct because of us. And because of things we've done, but we could potentially steer that in a more positive direction.
Yeah, I definitely love the idea that you think, or the way you want to use dinosaurs to try and create as many people with a vested interest in the natural world as possible.
Yeah, I think if I could pinpoint one moment that that made me think this is the right thing to be doing. We were having this conversation last night. I was having a conversation with somebody at the Lyme Regis Fossil Festival earlier this year when I was selling my book there. And a lady picked up a copy of the book and said, oh, I think my son might like this. I'll take a copy for him. And then she went out of her way to come back to the sort of vendor's hall the next day to come and speak to me briefly and say, I just want to let you know that I brought home the book for my son. He read it twice, cover to cover. And then he got out his pencils and he started drawing the dinosaurs from your book.
Yeah.
And I've never felt that so intensely before, that like, this is the thing I should be doing. This is the kind of thing that I'm good at, and it's worthwhile.
And it only takes that effect on one person, doesn't it?
Yeah.
You know,
it makes it worth doing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and you should never underestimate the impact that kid then may have on friends.
Exactly.
Or if later on in his life, he or she was a son, wasn't it? He might inspire somebody else. And so that one moment, you have no idea the wide-ranging impact of that. And it must be such a nice, tangible thing that you can be like, it's had the impact that I want it to have.
Exactly.
I think that's a lovely, lovely point.
Yeah, absolutely.
Probably a really nice place to round up. Apart from to say, if people want to find you, your comics, places where they can support your work, where they can buy your book, where should people go?
So you can find all of my stuff via my Linktree. So linktree.com/speed.thief. Most of my work goes up on Instagram. That's sort of my biggest platform. There are extra things on Patreon and comics go up there early. You can get my relatively new self-published book, Speed of Thief Volume 1, which is a compilation of a bunch of my work from the past 3 years or so. You can get that on my Etsy store. But yeah, more than anything, come and see what's happening on Instagram. New comics on there relatively frequently. And by all means, if anybody has any more questions about dinosaurs, birds, or birds in the context of dinosaurs, please do reach out.
Amazing. Thanks so much for coming all the way down to be on our podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Sean, it's been an absolute pleasure and so interesting. The only thing I'm disappointed is I didn't, in my quickfire question, say Dinocon or Comic-Con.
I've never actually done Comic-Con before, but maybe next year.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm going to absolutely, I'm going to roll out the red carpet for Dinocon.
Yeah,
it was the inaugural Dinocon in Exeter this weekend, which is why I'm in the South. Also to be on the Birdie Book Pod, of course. And it was a roaring success, pun intended. So I'd say if you have any interest in dinosaurs, if you have children or, you know, adult friends and relatives that are interested in dinosaurs, come along to DinoCon next year.
I think we'll be there.
Then that's amazing. I think we should all, like say, in a world where so much negativity happens, should all just embrace our inner dinosaur phase and go back and enjoy the world of dinosaurs.
Exactly.
Yeah. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
Sean, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
We'll look forward to our next episode.
Yeah, we'll catch you next time. Normal influence stuff. Don't forget to go find us over on our Instagram at the Birdie Bug Pod and go and find Sean at Speed. Is it speed.thief?
Speed.thief. Speed.thief.
But thank you for listening.
Thanks very much.
Bye.